Gospel Project material today. We're going to cover a whole lot. It's unit chapter 3, verses session 4, which will be Genesis 26 through 32 in part. We're not going to look at every verse. We're going to look at a lot of it and even some things outside of that. The lesson is titled A Plan Unhindered. And what we want to do today is just survey the Abraham, Isaac, Jacob story, really with a special emphasis on Isaac and Jacob. And what we're curious about, today's big question is, how does God work his will through flawed people? We have this idea that in Scripture, God has a purpose that we've seen in previous lessons, and that that purpose is going to work through Abraham and his descendants. What if Abraham's not a great person? What if his descendants are not great people? Does God still get his way, is the question, and how does he do that? And today we're going to see a lot of examples of sin, flaws, dysfunction. I always kind of laugh when people say they want traditional biblical family values. I know what they mean by that. Like, that's, I know what you mean. But there's part of me that always wants to laugh and say, have you read Genesis? Traditional families in Genesis are terrible. All the families in Genesis are terrible. We don't want families like those. And today will probably serve to illustrate that. Point one, God's plan continues despite sin and deception. What are we talking about? Well, we're going to start with the life of Isaac. This is after the binding and almost sacrifice of Isaac in chapter 22. Isaac has now gone his own way. He's found a wife. He's given a wife, rather, by Abraham and his servant. I'm of the opinion that Isaac is somewhat estranged from Abraham. I think the text bears that out, but not everyone agrees with me on that. In any event, he's living his own story, and I suspect trying not to be like his dad, except he ends up exactly like his dad in every way. So, for example, Genesis 26 in verses 1 and 6. Now, there was a famine in the land besides the previous famine in Abraham's time, and Isaac went to Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, in Gerar. So Isaac stayed in Gerar. So there's a famine in the land, and the text says, you know, like there was a famine in the time of Abraham, just kind of your hint. This is going to be really similar to the Abraham story. And what does Isaac do? He travels to the land of Gerar. What's notable about that? It's the same place Abraham went to. And in Genesis 20 and verse 1, now Abraham moved on from there into the region of the Negev and lived between Kadesh and Shur. For a while, he stayed in Gerar. So again, Isaac, nothing like Abraham, right? He's just going to live in exactly the same place due to a famine. That was the same situation that Abraham had. And the Lord appeared to Isaac and said, do not go down to Egypt. Live in the land where I will tell you to live. Stay in this land for a while, and I will be with you and will bless you. For to you and your descendants I will give all these lands and will confirm the oath I swore to your father Abraham. So there's a famine in the land, and Isaac plans to go down to Egypt. God tells him not to, and mentions Abraham. Due to a famine, Isaac plans on going down to Egypt. Who does that remind us of? Well, in Genesis 12, now there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to live there for a while because the famine was severe. So nothing new here, doing exactly what Abraham, his father, had done. How much is the story going to be like Abraham? God's going to mention Abraham a whole lot and make the same promises. I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and will give them all these lands, and through your offspring all nations on earth will be blessed because Abraham obeyed me and did everything I required of him in keeping my commands, my decrees, and my instructions. So it's not even based on anything you've done. It has to do with what your father did, that I have made this promise, the same promise I made to him, I make to you based on him. Isaac, remember when he almost sacrificed you? Because of that, I'm making you this promise. Then verse 7, when the men of the place asked him about his wife, Isaac is deeply concerned that his wife is beautiful and he'll be done harm. He said, she is my sister, because he was afraid to say, she is my wife. He thought the men of this place might kill me on account of Rebekah because she is beautiful. Now, where would Isaac have gotten the idea that to save his life so that people don't take his wife and kill him, he should pretend that she is his sister? Oh, that's exactly what Abraham had done in Genesis chapter 20. Now, Abraham moved on from there into the region of Negev and lived between Kadesh and Shur for a while. He stayed in Gerar, and there Abraham said of his wife Sarah, "She is my sister." Back to Isaac, when Isaac had been there a long time, Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked down from a window and saw Isaac caressing his wife Rebekah. The details even here are frighteningly parallel. Isaac lies to a Philistine king named Abimelech. Do you want to know who Abraham lied to? And there Abraham said of his wife Sarah, "She is my sister." Then Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent for Sarah and took her. Probably not even the same person, just the way the years work out. There's no reason to think it's the same man. It could even be his grandson. But the point is that it's the same title or name, Abimelech. Melech in Semitic languages means king. So Abimelech may be some kind of title or just a reused family name. But again, the joke is that the guy has the same name as the man that Abraham lied to. This story is completely replaying itself out. So Abimelech summoned Isaac and said, "She is really your wife? Why did you say she is my sister?" Isaac answered him, "Because I thought I might lose my life on account of her." And Abimelech said, "What is this you have done to us? One of the men might have slept with your wife, and you would have brought guilt upon us." So Abimelech gave orders to all the people, "Anyone who harms this man will surely be put to death." Isaac's lie ends poorly, just like Dad. Because in the story of Abraham, that God came to Abimelech in a dream one night and said to him, "You're as good as dead because of the woman you have taken. She is a married woman." So again, all the way through this, we're getting the sense that this is just not going to go well, that we're repeating all of the same mistakes that Abraham had made, and we're going to get the same results. So Isaac moved away from there, and he camped in the valley of Gerar, where he settled. Isaac reopened the wells that had been dug in the time of his father Abraham, when the Philistines had stopped up after Abraham died, and gave the same names his father had given them. How much are we repeating Abraham's life story? We're going to the same wells. We're digging the same wells. We're even giving them the same names. This is an intentional parallel to the story of Abraham. And then we're going to get a dispute over those wells. Isaac's servants dug in the valley and discovered a well of fresh water there, but the herders of Gerar quarreled with those of Isaac and said, "The water is ours." So he named the well Esek because they disputed with him. Then they dug another well, but they quarreled over that one also, so he named it Sitna. He moved on from there and dug another well, and no one quarreled over it. He named it Rehoboth, saying, "Now the Lord has given us room, and we will flourish in the land." If that sounds familiar, Isaac has a dispute with other herdsmen in the region. Abraham had the same problem with his nephew Lot and their herdsmen. The land could not support them while they stayed together, and quarreling arose between Abraham's herders and Lot's. The moral of the story, and we don't want just a moral from these stories, we want something bigger, but let's start with a moral. Isaac believed he could make his father's choices without his father's consequences. For whatever reason, Isaac's life just replays the mistakes of Abraham. I don't even know how much of it is intentional, to be honest. Sometimes I'll find myself in a posture that I'll just kind of look at myself and think, this is exactly how I remember my dad standing. And I think, how does that happen? Is it learned? Is it genetics? I don't know. We end up a lot like our fathers. That's the way it goes. And for better or worse, we get some of the good things, we hope, and we certainly get some of the bad things. That's just the way that relationship works. Isaac had a difficult relationship with his father, I'm quite convinced. And yet he ends up doing a lot of the same things. And it goes poorly. I suspect that Isaac thought that it wasn't a big deal. For example, he could lie about his wife, and there wouldn't be a cost. It quickly got away from him. The fact is, there's no escaping the price of sin. You make those choices, there are consequences. In fact, not only is there no escaping the price of sin is always more than we think it will be. It's always more convoluted, always reaches out its little tentacles further into our lives and does us harm. And we just doubt that for some reason. The gospel message, though, is more important than just the moral. And that is that Isaac's sins and flaws do not undermine God's purpose any more than Abraham's sins and flaws had. You look at Isaac and you see a deeply flawed individual making awful mistakes, and God's purpose continues through him. It's not a problem. He's still the son of promise. He's not the son of promise because he's a great man. He's the son of promise because God had said he's the son of promise. That's it. There's nothing more to that. In fact, they're not even new failures and flaws. I think sometimes, to make a contrast here, sometimes we think that our sin has no consequences. Sometimes we think we're doomed because of our failures. Your failures aren't new. Isaac made the same sins and flaws that his father had, and God's purpose had made its way to Isaac, and it would make its way to his son as well. So the gospel message is that God's purpose, the good news is that God's purpose isn't dependent on our righteousness in that way. He gets his will regardless. In fact, we could go further into the story and say God's plan continues despite family dysfunction. If you think your family's a little odd, you ain't seen nothing yet. There is no family like the Isaac family. It is definitely dysfunctional. Just to give a little summary, we get the story of Jacob and Esau, who in the text were even wrestling in the womb, twin brothers. Jacob grabs Esau's heel on the way out, and it's kind of a metaphor for their life together. Chapter 25, we get the story of Jacob trading Esau for his birthright for a bowl of stew. Esau didn't value it very highly. Jacob valued it very highly, but went about getting it in a lousy way. Esau was the firstborn. Jacob gets the birthright of the firstborn by trading it for, you know, porridge. And then in chapter 27, there's the story of a blessing. Isaac's getting ready to bless his sons, and the blessing and the birthright are connected. I don't know, they're necessarily different. They're connected. But I think in Jacob's mind, it wasn't his yet, right? He had got it by deceit, and he doesn't feel like he has it. So he comes with a plan with Rebekah, his mother, to deceive Isaac into giving him the blessing instead of Esau. So following up one deception with another, he pretends to be Esau. Isaac is very old and can't see, and so he blesses Jacob as opposed to Esau. Well, at that point, Esau's so angry that he's going to kill him. So Jacob leaves the land and goes to another land and works for a man named Laban. And there meets a beautiful young woman named Rachel that he would like to marry. Jacob works 7 years in order to get the right to marry Rachel from Laban. But Laban tricks him into marrying Leah, her sister. Turns out the trickster gets tricked. Deception leads to deception. Jacob works 7 more years to marry Rachel, whom he loves more than Leah. At this point in the story, no one's getting along. Jacob and Laban aren't getting along. Rachel and Leah aren't getting along. I mean, imagine you've been married to this man, and he says, yeah, not who I want to marry. I'll work 7 more years in order to marry your sister, who I like better. Right. This is not a good relationship. As if polygamy is ever a good relationship, oftentimes people will say, well, why does the Bible approve of polygamy in the Old Testament? It doesn't. It describes polygamy, but every story about polygamy in the Old Testament is terrible. Like, it always ends badly, and this is just a proof case of that. Rachel and Leah get along horribly. No one's getting along. Jacob obviously favors Rachel, so Leah feels slighted. And so the Lord shows her some pity. When the Lord saw that Leah was not loved, he enabled her to conceive, but Rachel remained childless. Leah became pregnant and gave birth to a son. She named him Reuben, for she said, "It is because the Lord has seen my misery. Surely my husband will love me now." Okay, so we have a child born out of misery and named with, I don't know, spite? Like, this will win my husband's affections. Nothing good has ever come from that motivation. Ah, now he'll love me. It doesn't work that way. But that's going to be the motivation throughout this story. The next verse, she conceived again. And when she gave birth to a son, she said, "Because the Lord heard that I am not loved, he gave me this one too." So she named him Simeon. Like, she can't love her son just for her son's sake. She can't just be happy about it. In her mind, this is part of this ongoing game of winning the affection of Jacob. Is it going to work? Well, apparently it didn't work the first time. Having a son doesn't make someone love you. But in her mind, well, I have another one. And so God will give me this one too. So she has a second. She names him Simeon. Again, she conceived. It worked so well the first time and the second time. Again, she conceived, and when she gave birth to a son, she said, "Now at last my husband will become attached to me because I have borne him three sons." So she has named him Levi. You see the dysfunction? She's just having sons to try to get Jacob to love her. And it's not working. You know, they say the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. The first one didn't do it. The second one didn't do it. The third one doesn't do it. He doesn't love you. Not like he loves Rachel. And there's nothing that having children is going to do, but she keeps bringing children into the world thinking that's going to do it. And that can't be good for anybody's relationship. She conceived again. And when she gave birth to a son, she said, "This time I will praise the Lord." So she named him Judah. Then she stopped having children. This is the only one that has anything positive attached to it. Like, this time she's just grateful. She's not, no scheme, no plan, no spite, just I'm grateful to God for this child. And then that's the end. And that would be a decent conclusion to the story, except it's not. The next chapter, Rachel saw that she was not bearing Jacob any children. She became jealous of her sister. Think about this now. Leah is only having children because she doesn't feel loved by Jacob. Rachel, who is loved by Jacob, feels jealous of Leah, who's having the children. Complete dysfunction. She said to Jacob, "Give me children or I'll die." Jacob became angry with her and said, "Am I in the place of God who has kept you from having children?" Then she said, "Here is Bilhah, my servant. Sleep with her so that she can bear children from me and I too can build a family through her." Jacob says, "You know, I don't have any control over this in the way that you want. I can't make you fertile. I can't make you have children when you're not." And so she comes up with a scheme, "Sleep with my handmaid." Where have we heard that before? Oh, we've heard that before in the life of Abraham and the story of Hagar. Did that story end well? No, it ended horribly. How is this story going to end? Also horribly. So she gave him her servant Bilhah as a wife. Jacob slept with her, and she became pregnant and bore him a son. Then Rachel said, "God has vindicated me. He has listened to my plea and given me a son." Because of this, she named him Dan. Right? So, yeah, this is going to fix it. We'll have a kid. Has having a son fixed anything else in this family? No. Rachel's servant Bilhah conceived again and bore Jacob a second son. Then Rachel said, "I've had a great struggle with my sister, and I have won." So she named him Naphtali. Again, is this love for children and family? No, this is spitefully getting back at my sister. We're having a feud and I won. It's just so petty and dysfunctional. When Leah saw that she had stopped having children, now again, pendulum's going to swing back the other way, she took her servant Zilpah and gave her to Jacob as a wife. Right? Worked with Rachel and her handmaid. Let's have another handmaid involved. Leah's servant Zilpah bore Jacob a son. Then Leah said, "What good fortune." So she named him Gad. Leah's servant Zilpah bore Jacob a second son. Then Leah said, "How happy I am. The women shall call me happy." So she named him Asher. During wheat harvest, Reuben, this is a funny story to me, went out to the fields and found some mandrake plants, which he brought to his mother Leah. Rachel said to Leah, "Please give me some of your son's mandrakes." But she said to her, "Wasn't it enough that you took away my husband? Will you take away my son's mandrakes too?" "Very well," Rachel said. "He can sleep with you tonight in return for your son's mandrakes." I'm not a licensed counselor. I have some training in counseling, limited. I do what's called pastoral counseling, which is under the auspice of being a minister of the gospel. And I can give some advice if it gets where I feel like I need to recommend someone to a trained counselor. I do that. But I think I qualified enough to look at this story and say, this is the height of dysfunction. Pettiness, bartering, using sex and childbearing as a weapon against the other is just beyond sanity. So when Jacob came in from the fields that evening, Leah went out to meet him. "You must sleep with me," she said. "I have hired you with my son's mandrakes." Wouldn't that make a great, like, graphic shirt? You know, one of your favorite Bible verse. "You must sleep with me. I have hired you for my son's mandrakes." I want to know if that sentence has ever been said ever in the history of the world, except in this story. What a strange, strange scene. And yet in the moment, it makes sense to them. Like Leah thinks, yeah, this makes sense. And you look at it from a distance and say, this is bizarre. So he slept with her that night. God listened to Leah and she became pregnant and bore Jacob a fifth son. Then Leah said, "God has rewarded me for giving my servant to my husband." So she named him Issachar. Remember, Leah says, God's rewarding me for giving my servant. What if it's not a reward? What if it's a curse? Well, anyway, Leah conceived again and bore Jacob a sixth son. Then Leah said, God has presented me with a precious gift. This time, my husband will treat me with honor because I have borne him six sons. So she named him Zebulun. See her again. Six sons in, and she's still trying to win Jacob's affection, and it's not working out, and it's not going to. Sometime later, she gave birth to a daughter and named her Dinah. Oh, I want to talk about Dinah, but I just don't have time in today's lesson. She's a whole story all on her own, except the text here has nothing to say except, well, Dinah. Why isn't Dinah mentioned more? Dinah doesn't get Leah any honor, right? Not a son. So she's not important. She can't love Dinah for Dinah. It's just, well, that doesn't help me with Jacob. And so we just pass over Dinah. Then God remembered Rachel. So the pendulum is going to swing back the other way. Leah's had the upper hand. He listened to her and enabled her to conceive. She became pregnant and gave birth to a son and said, God has taken away my disgrace. She named him Joseph and said, may the Lord add to me another son. Immediately says, and I want another. Again, not content with anything. This is not about the joy of childbirth. It's finally my disgrace is taken away, which is a big deal in the ancient world. I'm not trying to downplay that. But immediately says, boy, I need another to catch up with Leah. Later in the story, they moved to Bethel. And while they were still some distance from Ephrath, Rachel began to give birth and had great difficulty. And as she was having great difficulty in childbirth, the midwife said to her, don't despair, for you have another son. And as she breathed her last, for she was dying, she named her son Benoni, which means son of my sorrow. But his father named him Benjamin, which means son of my old age. Tragically, she had said, all what would make me happy, what would finally make me happy when nothing else happens, is one more son. If God would just give me one more son. God gives her one more son, and there's difficulty in the pregnancy, and she dies. And the handmaid even says, you know, don't despair. You got everything you wanted. And then she died. She didn't get what she wanted. I went through a lot of verses there for a reason. Folks, a family treated like a possession or an idol becomes a dysfunctional family. That's not the purpose of family. It's not the role of family in your life. If you treat it like a possession, something to get you status, you will crush it. If you treat it like an idol, like a god that is there to give you fulfillment in and of itself, your family can't do that. Family is a good thing, but there are times when I've seen people put legitimately too much emphasis on family. And what I mean by that is they try to put it in the place in their life where God ought to be. And you end up crushing your family with that. Your family is not a possession to gain you status. It is not a god to give you fulfillment. It is a gift of God, and anything else is going to destroy your family. The gospel message, though, is Jacob's failures as a father did not undermine God's purpose any more than had Abraham's or Isaac's. Abraham's not a great father. Isaac's not a great father. Jacob's not a great father. Does the gospel fail? Does the purpose of God fail? No, it's not dependent on those things. It's good news, because I'm not a great father. That God's purpose in my life can be worked regardless. God's plan continues through changed people. And for this, we fast forward to kind of the latter half of the life of Jacob. Jacob was left alone. He's on his way back for the context to meet with Esau and to be reunited, and he's concerned about how that's going to go. Jacob's left alone, and a man wrestled with him till daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, let me go, for it is daybreak. But Jacob replied, I will not let you go unless you bless me. Jacob meets this man. He's obviously an extraordinary man. Why? Because Jacob is under the impression that he could get a blessing from him. Isn't that interesting? Jacob, his entire life, has wanted a blessing, to be favored by God. Thing is, Jacob had spent his entire life wanting the best thing, but seeking it in all the worst ways. Whether it's metaphorically in grabbing his brother's heel, trading his brother for the birthright, deceiving his father for the birthright, Jacob wanted the best things, but he went about it in all the worst ways. And now he thinks he can wrestle this strange being to the ground and demand a birthright. As you look at the story, how does the wrestling match go? The text says, on the one hand, Jacob can't be overpowered, like he doesn't let go. He really wants the birthright and is going to hang on no matter what. On the other hand, this being, this figure, just touches Jacob and dislocates his hip, which I assume is extraordinarily painful. So how can a being be that strong and yet he can't get free of Jacob? What I think the text is displaying is this idea that Jacob is just determination incarnate. He's hanging on. He's not winning. He's just hanging on. And he finally says, I'm not letting go until you give me a birthright. I don't think he has this being in a headlock. I think he's down around his ankles. The man says, what is your name? And Jacob answered. Then the man said, your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with humans and have overcome. But Jacob said, please tell me your name. But he replied, why do you ask my name? Then he blessed him there. So Jacob called the place Penuel, meaning it is because I saw God face to face and yet my life was spared. Only at the end does Jacob realize he had had a close encounter with some kind of heavenly being who is standing in the place of God, possibly as God himself. It's hard to know exactly what's going on. This person is called a man, and another text, an angel and God. So I suspect it's an angel in the form of a person representing God is what I think is going on. But that's just my take on it. But what's important is Jacob realized, while that was a close call, that this could have gone horribly. Jacob wants the right thing. He goes about it in all the wrong ways. And he gets his name changed because there's been a change in Jacob. Jacob becomes Israel, and Jacob's new name represents a shift in himself and his relationship with God. The man who thought he could deceive his way into a blessing, I think, died that night. I think he got beat up. And instead, a man learned that he has to beg. But it's only in beseeching the grace and favor of God that we receive his blessings. And that change is a marked shift. How do I know that Jacob doesn't end well in this, that he doesn't overpower this being? I mean, the very next verse says, the sun rose above him as he passed Peniel. He was limping because of his hip. I mean, he got beat, right? He got beat up bad by this angelic being. But he begged. In fact, this is the way Hosea describes it. Listen to this verse. The Lord has a charge to bring against Judah. He will punish Jacob according to his ways and repay him according to his deeds. In the womb, he grasped his brother's heel. As a man, he struggled with God. He struggled with the angel and overcame him. How did he do that? He wept and begged for his favor. He found him at Bethel and talked with him there. The Lord God Almighty, the Lord is his name. How did Jacob overcome the angel? He wept and he begged. He didn't put him in a headlock. The angel wins, but Jacob begs. The moral of this blessing is something we need to learn from all the lessons of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and all the scheming and all the effort. The struggle with the angel in Jacob's life leads to a humility which leads to the blessing. He'd wanted the blessing all along, but he tried to take it. Only in humility does he finally receive a blessing, truly. I think the moral is you cannot take what only God can give. That's not the way this is going to work. But what's the gospel message here? I think the gospel message, again, is that God worked his purpose through Jacob, not by changing his purpose, but by changing Jacob. He overcame the flaws of Jacob and changes him to be the kind of person he needs him to be. So the moral of today's lesson is, I know Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are these fabled heroes of faith, and they are, you know, great role models in some parts of their life. They are disasters in other parts of their life. If you are a deeply flawed, sinful person, you're in good company with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God can work his purpose in your life through your sins, through your flaws, through your dysfunction. But it happens when you stop trying to take what only God can give, when you submit to him and look to his grace rather than trying to take what only God can give.